Okay, so get this. Imagine you're in prison,
Okay.
wrongly accused of a horrible crime, and a fellow inmate who you think is your friend offers you protection from the dangerous environment, but there's a catch.
Oh.
He wants you to confess to the crime.
Wow.
Do you take the deal?
That is the intense situation at the heart of Arizona v. Fulminante. It's a Supreme Court case that really makes you think about the limits of confession evidence.
We are going deep into this case today.
Yeah.
It deals with coerced confessions and this idea of harmless error in trials.
Right.
Our listener has shared some really interesting sources about this case, so let's get right to it.
Okay.
The story centers around Oreste Fulminante, a man on death row for killing his 11-year-old stepdaughter, Jeanne Michelle Hunt. But the path to his conviction is full of twists and turns.
Yeah, it's a tragic case, no doubt. Before we even get to the confessions, it's important to set the scene. Jeanne's death was a shock to the community. And while Fulminante was a suspect early on, there wasn't enough to charge him right away.
Oh, wow.
He actually ended up in prison for something totally unrelated, a firearms offense in New York.
And that's where things take a turn, right?
Exactly. In prison, he meets Anthony Saravola, another inmate who seems friendly at first.
Okay.
But here's the catch.
Uh-oh.
Saravola was actually a paid FBI informant.
Wow.
He'd heard rumors about Fulminante possibly being involved in Jeanne's death and saw an opportunity.
So this wasn't just a chance prison encounter. This sounds like a calculated move by the FBI.
It was.
What happened next?
Well, Saravola, knowing the kind of pressure Fulminante was under, in that prison environment, offered him protection from other inmates.
Okay.
But the price of that protection was a confession. He essentially told Fulminante, tell me the truth about what happened and I'll keep you safe.
Wow. Talk about a high-stakes pressure cooker. So Fulminante confessed.
He did under those circumstances. Facing potential danger and seeing a way out, Fulminante confessed to Saravola. And later on, he even confessed again to Saravola's wife.
So we've got these confessions. That seems pretty damning right. But I'm guessing there's more to the story.
You're right. Those confessions became central to the case against Fulminante when he was eventually charged with Jeanne's murder in Arizona. But Fulminante and his defense team fought back, arguing that the first confession, the one made to Saravola in prison, was completely coerced.
I can see why they'd argue that.
Yeah.
He was vulnerable, facing threats in a dangerous prison.
Yeah.
And this informant was essentially dangling a lifeline in exchange for a confession.
Right.
It doesn't exactly sound like a free and voluntary admission of guilt.
Exactly. The defense argued that the promise of protection in that context amounted to coercion. So the case went to the Arizona Supreme Court, and they initially upheld the conviction.
Really?
They thought even if that first confession was problematic, there might be other evidence strong enough to make that error harmless.
Hold on. Harmless error. So they're saying that even if a confession is obtained through coercion, which seems like a major violation of someone's rights, it might not matter if there's other evidence.
That was their initial thought, yes.
Wow. But then, in a dramatic turn of events, the Arizona Supreme Court took a second look at the case and completely reversed themselves.
Wow, that's a huge reversal. What led them to such a dramatic change of heart?
They determined that the very nature of a coerced confession fundamentally undermines the fairness of a trial. They argued that allowing such a confession, even with other evidence, casts doubt on the entire process.
Really makes sense. So what happened next? Did the prosecution just give up?
Not a chance. This was a death penalty case, and the stakes were incredibly high. The prosecution appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the whole country was watching to see how they would handle this legal hot potato.
So now the case is in the hands of SCOTUS. What were the big questions they had to grapple with?
They had two major issues to decide. First, was Fulminante's confession to Saravola actually coerced, given the circumstances? And second, could a coerced confession ever, ever be considered harmless error in a trial?
That second question is fascinating. It really gets to the heart of what we consider a fair trial. And I'm betting the Supreme Court's decision wasn't exactly straightforward.
You're right about that. Their ruling was a real curveball, and it created shockwaves in the legal system.
All right. So the Supreme Court has this incredibly complex case before them. On one hand, you have a confession that seems to be coerced.
Yeah.
And on the other, this idea that maybe it doesn't matter if there's other strong evidence.
Mm-hmm.
What do they decide?
Well, in a 5-4 decision, the court agreed that Fulminante's confession was indeed coerced.
Okay.
But here's the twist.
Oh.
They also said that in some cases, a coerced confession could be subject to a harmless error analysis.
Wait, so they're saying that even if your rights are violated,
Even if a confession is forced out of you, it might not matter in the end. That seems kind of backwards.
It definitely complicates things. The majority of the justices distinguish between trial errors and structural errors.
Nope.
Trial errors, they argued, are things that happen during a trial that can be weighed against other evidence. Structural errors, on the other hand, completely undermine the fairness of the whole trial.
Okay, so where do coerced confessions fall in that framework?
They decided that coerced confessions are serious, but they fall under the category of trial errors. They argued that unlike, say, denying someone the right to a lawyer, which would be a structural error, a coerced confession doesn't taint the entire trial process.
So does that mean Fulminante was out of luck? Did the court just say, tough break, your confession was coerced, but there was other evidence, so your conviction stands?
Not quite. Even though the court said that a coerced confession could potentially be a harmless error, they found that in Fulminante's specific case, the prosecution had leaned too heavily on that tainted confession.
Ah, so they're saying the prosecution's case was basically built on that confession.
Exactly. The court said it was impossible to know for sure whether the jury would have convicted Fulminante without that confession. So they sent the case back to Arizona for a new trial without the coerced confession being admitted as evidence.
I bet that decision got some strong reactions.
You're absolutely right. The four dissenting justices were vehemently opposed to the majority opinion. They argued that the confession wasn't coerced at all, and that the other evidence against Fulminante was more than enough to convict him, regardless of the confession.
So they believe the court was setting a dangerous precedent.
Precisely. They were concerned that this decision would make it harder to prosecute criminals, even when there was other strong evidence, because it opened the door to challenging confessions.
It sounds like this case really shook things up in the legal world.
It did.
Why is Arizona v. Fulminante considered such a landmark decision?
Well, before this case, coerced confession was basically an automatic win for the defendant. If the court found that a confession was coerced, it was pretty much guaranteed that the conviction would be overturned. Fulminante changed all of that.
So it added a whole new layer of complexity to these kinds of cases.
Exactly. Now courts have to do this balancing act. They have to look at the confession, how it was obtained, and all the other evidence in the case, to decide whether the confession actually influenced the jury's decision.
That sounds like a really tough job.
Yeah.
How do courts actually go about making that determination?
It's a complex process, and there's no easy answer. They have to weigh a lot of factors, like the strength of the other evidence, how central the confession was to the prosecution's case, and the overall fairness of the trial.
It makes you wonder, was the Fulminante decision a step forward or backward for justice?
That's a question that's still debated to this day. On the one hand, it seems like it could potentially weaken protections against coerced confessions.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it does acknowledge that there are situations where a coerced confession might not be the deciding factor in a case, and that other evidence should be considered.
So it's not a simple black and white issue.
Not at all. It's a really nuanced area of law. And the Fulminante case brought those nuances to the forefront.
It sounds like this case really opened up a can of worms. Are there any other important takeaways for our listeners?
I think the biggest takeaway is that confessions are powerful. But Arizona v. Fulminante reminds us that we have to scrutinize them carefully. We can't just assume that a confession is always reliable or that it was obtained fairly.
So it's a cautionary tale for both law enforcement and the courts.
Absolutely. It highlights the importance of due process and ensuring that everyone's rights are protected, even when they're accused of a serious crime.
Well, this has been a fascinating deep dive into a really complex case. But before we wrap things up, I'd love to get your perspective on something. We've talked a lot about the legal arguments and the court's decision. But what about the human element to this story?
That's a great point. It's easy to get caught up in the legal intricacies, but we can't forget that there are real people at the heart of this case.
Exactly. What was going through Fulminante's mind when he was in that prison facing threats? And this offer of protection in exchange for a confession. And what about the informant Saravola? What were his motivations?
Those are important questions, and they take us beyond the legal arguments into the realm of psychology and ethics. It's a reminder that the law is not just about abstract principles. It's about real people and the choices they make under extraordinary pressure.
It feels like this case really throws a wrench into things for prosecutors.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if they can't rely on a confession, even if they think they have other strong evidence, doesn't that tie their hands?
That's a valid point. Arizona v. Fulminante definitely raised the bar. Yeah. For prosecutors, they can't just bank on a confession to win their case, especially if there's any suspicion of coercion.
Right.
They need to build a solid case, independent of any confession.
So what does that look like in practice? What kind of evidence are we talking about?
Think about things like forensic evidence, witness testimonies that back up key details, a strong timeline placing the defendant at the scene of the crime.
Okay.
Anything that paints a clear picture of guilt without relying on the defendant's own words.
It's like they need a safety net in case a confession gets thrown out.
Precisely. And on the flip side, this case is a significant victory. For defense attorneys, it gives them ammunition to challenge confessions that were obtained under questionable circumstances.
Right.
They can now argue that even if their client confessed, it doesn't automatically mean they're guilty.
So it's almost like Arizona v. Fulminante leveled the playing field a bit.
In a way, yes. It compels both sides to be more thorough, build stronger cases, and scrutinize the evidence more carefully.
All right, for our listeners out there, navigating the legal world, what are the key takeaways from Arizona v. Fulminante? What should they be thinking about?
First and foremost, always be wary of confessions. Don't just take them at face value.
Okay.
Consider the context, the circumstances surrounding the confession, and whether any pressure or coercion might have been involved.
So it's not just about what's said, but how it's said. And the conditions under which it was said.
Precisely. Second, it's crucial to understand the distinction between trial errors and structural errors.
Okay.
This case underscores just how important that difference is.
Right, because a structural error is like a fatal blow to a trial, while a trial error might be salvageable.
Exactly. And finally, keep in mind that the harmless error analysis is far from simple. It's a complex weighing of factors, and courts will look at all the evidence to determine whether a confession truly influenced the jury's decision.
It's not just a box to check.
Mm-hmm.
On a legal form, it's a nuanced and often subjective judgment call.
Precisely. Arizona v. Fulminante is a stark reminder that the law is rarely black and white. It's full of gray areas and judgment calls. That can have huge implications.
It sounds like Arizona v. Fulminante wasn't just a legal case. It was a story about human fallibility, the pressures of the justice system, and the constant struggle to balance individual rights with the pursuit of truth.
I think that's a great way to sum it up, and it's a story that continues to resonate today, reminding us that the fight for justice is an ongoing process, and we all have a role to play in ensuring that the system works fairly for everyone.
Well, I think we've successfully navigated the intricacies of this landmark case. What final thoughts do you have for our listeners? Before we wrap up our deep dive,
I'd encourage everyone to think about the broader implications of Arizona v. Fulminante. How has it affected police interrogations? How do we balance the need for confessions with the protection of individual rights? These are questions worth pondering.
Excellent points to consider. So until our next deep dive, keep those legal minds sharp and never stop questioning the complexities of the justice system.